Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Rado Palamariu, Managing Director of LCAP Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem globally by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Christian Lang, who is the CEO of TradeShift. TradeShift drives supply chain innovation for the digitally connected economy. They raised about $400 million and are currently valuation at $1.1 billion, and they are one of the leaders in supply chain payments and marketplaces by helping buyers and suppliers digitize all their trade transactions, collaborate on every process, and connect with any supply chain app. They currently have more than 1.5 million companies across 190 countries that use their platform to process over $500 billion in transactional value, making it actually the largest global business network for buying and selling. Christian is the CEO, co-founder, and chairman. He has a very interesting story. He started his first technology company at age 19 and was the youngest head of division in the Danish government on the National IT and Telecom Agency, where he co-founded and led the Danish Nemhandel project, EasyTrade, which was the first open source peer-to-peer trade platform. So Christian, pleasure to have you with us today, and thanks for making the time.
Oh, it's awesome to be here, and thank you so much for having me.
Super, and I'll actually start with your, I forgot about this part in your history. Age 19, you started an EasyTrade peer-to-peer trade platform as part of the Danish government. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, it's actually two different moments. So maybe I just start by separating. I did start a startup, my first company, when I was 19. But we worked in a very different space. We worked on the first generation of mobile browsers. We're happy to have, at that time, some pretty big customers. You know, in 99, when the first version of mobile internet was all the rage in Europe. But it was later in life, I was a little bit older, when we started EasyTrade. And EasyTrade was the Danish government's trade platform. And that was probably the very first purely internet-based protocol for trade, open source, everybody could download it and just join in. And that was around, I think we were 27, I was 27. So around 10 years later. My first company, but they're both really, really interesting projects back in the day.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I'm guessing that from EasyTrade, it kind of helped you jump and start TradeShift. So maybe tell us a little bit about the story of TradeShift, how you created it, how it evolved. I know that you were sharing the story of starting it in your own garage, which is a fairly cold place to be in Denmark in the winter time and spring and autumn, I guess. I think Denmark is pretty cold all year round. But tell us a little bit about that and TradeShift and how it started.
I think the general advice about starting a company near garage is a great idea if you live in California, less so if you live in Denmark. But we did it anyways, and I think it maybe motivated us to work really, really fast because we were all in agreement getting an office was a good idea so we could get some heat. I belong to the internet generation. In many ways, we're very lucky. We got World Wide Web while I was in high school, and, you know, we got to play around with this stuff very early, you know, and what was very clear to me, like a native, if you want, of the internet was there was so much potential here in connecting people and connecting things. And when we started EasyTrade back in 2004, we had a very, very simple vision, which was the easier it would be for companies to connect and do business together, the less friction there would be in that process, the better it would be for the economy, right? And it was actually a fairly provocative thing in 2004. With EDI networks and others been doing what they've been doing for many, many different years and fairly high complexity in connecting companies and running trade across different supply chains. So in a way, EasyTrade was a real sort of pioneer platform. We managed to connect almost 90% of the companies in Denmark to the platform. It was open source. Companies like Microsoft, Oracle, etc. all adopted the protocols and the standards, and it became the foundation for the European Union Project PEPL, which some listeners might have heard about, which is sort of the European level version of EasyTrade, which is also a project to standardize trade and e-invoicing across all of the European borders, right? So I think when we started TradeShift, it actually came from all of those lessons, but also I think that sort of pretty strong vision or even idealism, if you want, which is that there shouldn't be any friction for companies to connect and do business together. It should be as similar, easy as to connecting on LinkedIn. And while we, for EasyTrade and for Pebble, focused a lot on the technical standards, when we built TradeShift, we said, okay, now we can take all of those lessons that we have from those projects, but apply a different mindset of really just having one platform where everything just works out of the box. You don't need to be a technical genius to figure it out. What if you have a company somewhere, let's say in Southeast India, and you need to do business with a North American Fortune 500 company? Can we make that as easy as clicking three times on the mouse and saying yes? And if we can do that, and if we can take out most of the cost of that system, we're going to be building a very, very large network of trades. So that was the starting point, and that's where we started out with TradeShift as well. And you know, our thesis proved correct, right? So within 6 months of starting TradeShift, it had spread to 100 countries. And really, it was the job of all of the amazing sellers who joined the platform, and went and invited their customers and their sellers to the platform. We just grew organically out of the box, right?
So in 3 months, you said you reached 100 countries already.
Six months.
100.
We were sitting with Google Translate trying to figure out what on earth are they using TradeShift for in Malaysia, right? Because we had no idea.
That's incredible numbers. And I guess that's the virality of invoicing, right? I mean, you need to issue invoices, and you know everybody has different providers and different suppliers worldwide. But tell us a little bit, I want to get the profile of your customers, right? So I'm an executive search business, consulting business. I have, I don't know, 15, 20 people on our payroll, and we have a bunch of suppliers. And then you also work with really large, you know, the large logistics or manufacturing companies that have thousands and thousands of people. Can we all access your platform? Is there a limit? How you know, tell us a little bit about the profile of clients and how you help them.
Yeah, so our goal actually, I mean, if you think about it historically, software, especially business software, has always been made to a certain size of company, right? Like Oracle and SAP sell to the big guys, you know, Sage and QuickBooks sell to the small guys and the players in between and all of that, right? So it's sort of been segmented by size. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about software that's running inside the firewall of that company. But when you start thinking about trade, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because trade networks are sort of across all sizes of companies, right? If you're a huge Fortune 500 company, you typically have 10 to 50,000 suppliers of all sizes, from the guy that cuts the grass on your campus somewhere in Asia to the PC manufacturer that delivers the core, let's say, productivity PCs that you're using inside your offices, right? So in a way, a truly successful supply chain network needs to be able to seamlessly connect and do business for companies of all sizes. And that's a super interesting challenge, right? Because the software, and what we found was, you know what, if we make the software easy enough, simple enough, fast enough to understand for the guy that do clean your windows or cut your grass, that actually also benefits the enterprise user and inside the big enterprise. So this notion that you need complexity to serve the big guys, I actually think mostly is wrong. The simpler and easier you can make things, the easier and better the software will work in almost all use cases.
So let's take some examples. Let's maybe give us, I don't know if you want to segregate like that, but give us some examples of some clients that you're working with. You can specify names if you can. And how specifically did you, I don't know, cut their time, their complexity? Maybe if you have some tangible metrics that you saw improve after they started using TradeShift.
No, I mean, so in the early days, right, we built the TradeShift network. That was the first big tool we built, and it looks and feels a lot like LinkedIn. Anybody can join. You can go join with your business tomorrow, create a profile for your company, start doing business with your customers through the platform, all for free. But then, you know, a year after we launched, we started getting inbound leads from some of the largest companies in the world that says, we keep getting suppliers pinging us if we can do business on TradeShift. Do you guys have any enterprise tools? Because we have thousands and thousands of sellers that we need to manage. And, you know, being great entrepreneurs, we obviously said yes, showed up. and start talking to them about what were their use cases. And what we quickly found out was, for them, it was really about managing the whole enterprise payment process end to end, like everything from KYC of onboarding a seller, making sure that seller was compliant within the countries they were doing business, then running any kind of transaction between the buyer and the seller, that could be a purchase order, a quote, a payment, a logistics message, and making sure those were compliant, right? Maybe you live in Holland, or your company is headquartered in Holland, but you're shipping from Germany and you're sending the goods to France, but you're invoicing from Holland. Well, actually, there's different VAT rules than if you're invoicing from Germany. So that was a big, very complicated problem if you have 50,000 suppliers and you're a Fortune 500 company, right? And then all the way out to the working capital payment piece and payout. And what we found was, when we started, that was split across 10 to 15 different tools. You would have special software for KYC and master data management. You would have software for compliance and tax. You would have software for approvals, workflow. You had software for analytics, insights. You would have different platforms for the working capital piece. But it was all connected to the same problem, which was really managing your enterprise payment flow on a global level. So when we built the TradeShift Pay platform, which sits on top of our network, we were the first, I think, in the industry to sort of connect all of the dots between these many different sort of separate processes. And that became our first enterprise-grade product. And, you know, if you look at the general product, we have companies of all sizes using that all over the world. If you look at TradeShift Pay, we today have more than 600 plus enterprise customers, more than 100 Fortune 500 customers on that platform. They're pretty much within every single industry you can imagine: logistics, retail, manufacturing, finance, professional services. It really doesn't matter. We have customers both in all of these industries, but also with a global reach. So today we serve customers in more than 190 markets from the TradeShift Pay platform. So we're compliant in pretty much every single country you can imagine in the world. And that's sort of a big problem solver for the CFO, because they don't need to go and pick 50 different tools to solve this problem on a global level, right?
Absolutely. It's a major help. And I want to ask you the million-dollar question, because you mentioned that you started from a free model, you attracted lots of smaller enterprises, then you ended up, you know, selling to the bigger boys because they were knocking on your doors. By the way, incredible good problem to have. How do you make money? How do you currently monetize? Is it monetized as a normal software? I mean, I don't know. How does TradeShift make money?
Yeah, so first off, you know, just a little anecdote on the whole, the big guys knocking on the door, right? I think when you're a small startup, you always wish, oh my God, I wish I had three Fortune 500 companies as customers. And you know, that's my biggest dream. And then you get three Fortune 500 companies as customers, you go like, oh my God, I wish I didn't have them. So, you know, these customers, we are so proud of them. But I think when we were a small 70-man company, it almost killed the company, right? So, you really, there's a lot of things you have to solve and learn to solve at a whole different scale when you serve these guys. But today, obviously, super proud of we delivering to these guys, but it was not without growing pains. That's for sure, right? So back to your question on business model, right? Like, look, I pretty much, and I'm probably a little provocative here, I pretty much think the industry has gotten it completely wrong over the last 25 years, right? So the nexus of almost every single business model in this industry has been you pay per transaction and the sellers pay, right? So if you take something like the Ripa network, you pay $5,000 to $10,000 to join, then you pay 15 to 20 basis points for every single transaction. And the buyer obviously also pays something, but if you look at the total revenues, it's a fraction compared to what the sellers are paying overall, right? And I think that generates some deep problems because, you know, if I go to my customer and say, hey, of course you're my customer, but I'm earning more money on your suppliers than I am on you. Who's really the customer and what's the alignment, right? And from a sort of value perspective, I'll tell you, okay, I'll onboard your 10% largest suppliers because that's aligned with me, right? They have 50% of their transactions. So just from a pure volume number game, that's going to solve the most of your transactions. You're going to be happy. But in reality, that's not really how it works, right? If you take some of my large customers and we analyze where is actually the cost from the supplier base, it might be that the 10% largest suppliers is 50% of your transactions, but they're certainly not 50% of your costs, because they know what they're doing. They know how to send an invoice correctly. They know how to use POs, all of these things. But if you look at the tail end, you know, the thousands and thousands of suppliers that will call to ask about the invoice, who make mistakes in the invoices or the transactions, who have an issue, they typically cost far more than the last guys. But the incentive models are not aligned in the classical business model where it's the sellers you pay and per transaction. So we've done something very differently. We tell our customers, one, it's completely free for sellers because that's in your interest. That way we can maximize the digitalization of your supply chain, which is what you should wish for. We want to make every single seller in your supply chain as digital as possible. And number two, our business case is performance-based with the enterprise customer. So we say, if we can, you know, we'll guarantee that we can hit a certain digitization degree of your supply chain, and you will pay us a flat rate over 3 to 4 years if we hit that target, right? So we've, I think, really more than we disrupted on a technology level, we actually have disrupted on a commercial model by keeping it completely free for sellers, and two, making the pricing very, very transparent and performance-oriented with the buyers. It's clear if you're a CFO, okay, this is the value. And you don't, from an onboarding perspective, you don't create that friction in onboarding the sellers to a digital solution, right? If you're using a sort of traditional solution from one of our competing providers, right? I mean, every single rollout got to start with a call to the supplier that says, we have bad news and we have bad news. The bad news is we're going to switch you over to electronic business. Another bad news is you're now going to be paying a lot of money just for telling your customer that they owe you money, versus a call from the customers on our platform, which is we have bad news and we have good news. The bad news is we're going to switch you over to digital, and that can be a little cumbersome if you're not used to it before. But the good news is it's completely free. We take care of the migration, we take care of the integration, and you don't have to think about the pain point. And the reason this can work at scale is obviously that we are 2 or 3 generations ahead of technology where most of these solutions started out, right? So it's not true sort of classic where you want it to be necessarily that a lot of these networks, they charge. It's just if your technology platform is 15, 20 years old, then it costs a lot to operate all of these transactions. It costs a lot to operate all of this support you have around it, whereas we have automated most of the setup process, automated most of the integration process for the suppliers. And we are on a modern sort of very next generation cloud. So transactions it's not the biggest part of our cost. So we've been able to take away most of that cost that was part of that process. And that really created a much more frictionless onboarding. So that's the basis for our business model. And I'm sorry, I'm going to break here, because this is something I'm incredibly passionate about, so you can probably hear, and I'll let you follow up.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, feel free. It's definitely, I can feel the passion in your voice. And also, I'm processing the information, because I used to work for a big software company, and it is true that the models have been pretty standard. Like, even in my question, I asked you, like, do you charge like a software company, right? So intrigued, and I will look further into the model, because it makes a lot of sense, right, to charge per value. And also the fact that all the sellers are not charged makes it much, much easier for that onboarding. Which brings me to the point of asking you point blank, if you may. SAP Ariba, right? Probably one of your biggest competitors or frenemies or whatever you want to call it. I don't know how you want to call it.
We heard about them, yeah.
You heard about them. I also heard about them slightly in passing. And what's the difference between Tradeshift and SAP Ariba?
So I once did an interview where I said, again, maybe provocatively, that SAP Ariba, they don't really have customers, they have prisoners. That's not entirely true, but I think, look, Ariba is a great solution. It's a really great spend management platform. If you want to manage your procurement and spend, you know, it probably come down to 2 platforms, either Kuba or Ariba, and I mean, either are fine. I mean, they're great tools for what they do. But Tradeshift is a very, very different animal. And we often get boxed in with these guys. But in a way, you can say, if you buy Ariba or some other competing solution, what you get is a tool that can do one thing really great in your supply chain, right? So now you have a solution for running an RFP, doing a PO, managing a contract, and that's it. And if you want to do something else, you're rolling out a different tool. So we've got a big customer within you know, packaged goods, and they we talked to their suppliers, we audited their suppliers and said, hey, how many tools and processes and spreadsheets and PDFs and faxes are you dealing with to do business with this customer? And the average answer per supplier was 24 different tools and processes just to do business with one customer, where the procurement part was only one of those 24, right? Then the sourcing department, they had their own responsible sourcing app, finance, treasury, quality management, like it just went on and on and on, right? And what's really neat about the Traceive platform is it's a platform. You roll out the Traceive network to your supply chain, you pick a product like Traceive Pay, and of course that becomes your enabling process. But then we have more than 150 third-party apps in the platform that take care of everything from direct materials, logistics, responsible sourcing, carbon footprint, anti-slavery. And those are just apps that you activate, and now they're available on the digital platform you just roll out to all of your suppliers. So you're not paying for that cost over all over again, right? So if you really want to look at that comparison, it's really the question, how do a solution like Salesforce today compare to the last iteration of CRM products that could only do one thing? If you're buying Salesforce, you're not just buying a CRM, you're buying a whole sales ecosystem. And it's the same with Tradeshift, right? When you're buying Tradeshift, you're not just buying a solution for your payment process or AP automation or marketplaces, you're buying a supply chain ecosystem. And the most expensive part in the supply chain is not really the software cost, right? It's the change management cost. What cost is going out to 20,000 or 50,000 suppliers and get them to do something else. So if you can put a platform in like Tradeshift, then the future cost of change management pretty much goes to zero on every new process you want to switch out to your suppliers or change, right? So the change cost goes down dramatically. And I think sort of just to round that whole thing off on what's the difference here, right? With Ariba or Coupa or somebody else, you can bring down your transaction cost, but you're increasing your cost of change because it gets even harder to change something because now you have one solution that can only do what you want to do. It's like your old Nokia feature phone. If you want a new feature, you got to wait for Nokia to release a new version of the software, right? And with Tradeshift, it's like a smartphone. You're rolling a smartphone out in your supply chain, and if you want a new app, it's just like activating an app on your phone, and you can have a new process deployed in your supply chain overnight. So that's a big difference.
Huge difference. And like your provocation with the prisoner metaphor, I think it's quite common that you hear such rollouts and new things and the change management process to take, I don't know, easily between one, if you're optimistic, to 2, 3, 4 years, if you're realistic. And by the time you finish doing it, things have changed so much that sometimes you kind of wonder why you did it in the first place. So I think that's a major, it's a major issue that a lot of companies face. I looked at the numbers, so I was reading, and I hope it's accurate, that right now there's a trade flow. So the big number was half a trillion USD, or just to make it more practical for our listeners, that's about the 3 times the size of what Amazon does, which is maybe makes it more more real and easy to comprehend. So it's huge, basically. What's the plan from here? I mean, what's your future 1, 2, 3 years down the line? Where do you think you're going to go?
So first off, I think, you know, that's a number that, you know, on the business side, we love and we're proud of every day. And on the technical side, people, they get a wonderful challenge every day, right? It's a huge number. But it's also, I mean, it's growing, you know, easily 40 to 50% year over year, right? So it's a continuous challenge. It just doesn't stop tomorrow. But I think if you look at the future, you know, we think that next generation of B2B networks are going to be 100 to 1,000 times larger than what you've seen in the past. If you think about it on the consumer side, all software today as consumers is connected. You're not having a single app on your iPhone or Android that is not connected to some kind of network. That network could be, you know, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. It could be the App Store from Apple, but it's connected. And it has the ability to share, to interact, to collaborate, build in from day one, right? That's essentially what consumer software is about today. And B2B software, we're still discussing the move from on-prem to cloud, but we haven't really started discussing the move from cloud to network. And in consumer, we already finalized that move. There's nobody who would dream of using a standalone cloud application as a consumer anymore, right? It's all about how these connected and how we use them in our everyday lives to engage with others. So network has become the default as consumers, but it hasn't become the default yet as B2B. So I think when you start thinking about that future, you got to think about what do a totally network future for B2B look like? What would B2B software look like when the future is totally network? Do we really need to do most of the general ledger inside the enterprise? Or could we calculate it on the network on the fly as things are coming in? Do we need to wait till we have all of the data in the AP before we run analytics and cost savings numbers? Or could we actually also get that from a network level? How do we think about benchmarking? Do we want to optimize just for a single enterprise, or do we want to optimize for a whole value chain? So some pretty big questions about fundamentally how software works. And in a way, I think you can see all of the hype around blockchain as a metaphor for this. Now, blockchain has a lot of challenges as a technology. I think we're pretty far away from that particular implementation of networks to be the most important one. But I don't think we're very far away from capturing the imagination of what it means when everything becomes networked. And I think from Tracy's side, we care less about the technology. We think the technology is a little bit of a distraction as a discussion. But we think what's the most important discussion is what's the future of B2B software when it's networked. And we think there's so many super exciting use cases we haven't even explored yet and which is emerging.
I'm trying to comprehend that. I mean, whilst you're explaining it, the enormity of it, right? It's like LinkedIn, B2B LinkedIn, where, okay, you guys are very much specific on the trade, invoicing, all the flows that come with that, all the flows that come with supply chain. But indeed, if you manage to do it from a network perspective, to run algorithms, see the data and analyze the data in real time, then it's mind-blowing the type of power that you would have, right? And given the fact that you've reached a global scale so fast, again, you can do it at the global level, regional level, breaking down per country, a bunch of implications, right? So
just to give you two examples, actually, maybe to make it really sort of, practically relevant, because it, of course, is a big mind-blowing vision, but two sort of super practical real-world examples, right? So one is collaboration around a process, right? So in Traceif Network, if I send you an invoice and there's an issue with that invoice, in the past, what would happen is that invoice would just not be paid. Then 2 to 4 weeks later, I would give you a call. I would ask, hey, where's my money? You would tell me, hey, there was an issue with the invoice, so we haven't paid it yet. You would go back. You would have to create an exception, the new invoice or credit note be created, new invoice. And then maybe if you're lucky, you would eventually get paid, right? And it wastes a bunch of energy, bunch of time, bunch of people on both sides that are involved in resolving this problem. On a Tracy platform, if I send you an invoice, there's an issue with a line, the guy that's receiving the invoice, he can just mark that line and say, hey, we have an issue here. It opens up a collaboration with the sender, a little bit like Google Docs, so we're both looking at the same document. And there's a comment, a little bit like, comments in Google Docs or somewhere else, and says, hey, this line has an issue. You can real time together in the software on the document, collaborate, resolve the issue if it can be resolved straight away, and click OK, and now it's resolved, right? So that's one example, which is what we call shared or collaborative workflow. Instead of thinking about the workflow just inside the receiving side, what if we can resolve the issue with the transaction before it even gets into our EAP and we have an exception and we have to go through all of this pain, right? So that's one example of where having a network mindset when you build workflow, collaboration, exception handling, is massive valuable, right? The other example is on the AI and machine learning, right? So, there's sort of traditionally, whenever you receive a transaction, you try to match it so you can do straight through processing and not have humans touch it, right? So you might match it to a PO number, you might match it to, a contract, all of these things. But it's sort of a very primitive way of thinking about matching stuff, right? I mean, the chance that an invoice is going to break when it gets matched to a PO is actually fairly high. It can just be system differences. It can be how we name things. It can be small variances, but it's actually still a good invoice. So what we do instead is we use all of the network data we have on a global level. We look at all of the invoices this supplier has been sending out, all of the invoices this buyer has been receiving. And then we're using AI and machine learning on that particular transaction. We're looking at 4,000 to 5,000 data points for every single transaction. And we say, okay, you know, if we think like a human, should we approve or should we not approve this transaction? And then we see what the humans do, and we train the algorithms based on the human input to see what they do. We call this system Ada. It's our machine learning system for decisions. And right now, Ada is performing 15 to 20% better than humans on approvals, right? So what we're now starting to tell our customers is, you can turn off approvals for the majority of the organization and only run approvals on 5 to 10% of your users. Think about that as a random sample. And the rest will just be fully automated using Ada up to maybe a certain size, because CFOs are, of course, conservative people. And you still want to take certain transactions out and make sure humans look at them. And both are cases that are possible because we have a true network and we can build true network business processes. It's not just an enterprise application, right?
That brings me to a question that several of our listeners had in coming back to the point where you said that there is a bad news and a good news, and the bad news, you know, you got to go digital, right? The sellers have to go digital. How do you solve that? How do you, apart from, okay, there's zero cost to them, which definitely is a big help. But you have industries like, and you work with major logistics companies, and logistics is an industry, and shipping and trade and a lot of the things related to customs and ports and all of that, and other industries as well, are heavily paper-based, right? The traditional paper-based is still working through that. How do you kind of do that change management maybe with the sellers and suppliers and help them digitize often?
So I think, you know, I would love to say that we were super smart and strategic when we arrived at the solution to this. We weren't. It was sort of out of necessity. We started with sellers first. We didn't start with buyers. So that meant my first customers, even though it was free for them, was sellers all over the world just signing up to use my software to do business with the big customers, right? And that meant we couldn't really just rely on a big guy forcing them to do something. We really had to make sure that there was enough value. So the answer is actually incredibly simple to say, but very hard to do in practice. And the answer is, you just gotta make sure that there's enough value for those who need to change. It's as easy as that. And most solutions in this space have not tried to build enough value for the seller. They have relied on the push from the buyer. And that creates massive resistance. So even though you technically, the CFO of a big company can tell you, oh, you gotta use this to get paid, you might kind of do it, but you're not really going to do it. And if you resist, if you can, and all of these things. But if there's enough value, and we call up the sellers and we say, look, we need you to get on this platform, but here's all of the value you're going to get. You're going to get free payment status. You know exactly where your payment is. You can resolve any issue much faster. We can integrate to your backend system so you don't have to do double typing. You get access to get paid earlier than your invoice terms, just using the built-in financing solutions on the network. Then most sellers are like, oh, wow, this is super interesting. And you're not charging me, right? So the answer is very simple. Build more value for the seller so there's enough value in changing your behavior. That's a carrot. And then, but doing that in practice requires a lot of iteration, a lot of practice in actually just selling to sellers without relying on the stick of the buyer.
In terms of growing very fast, and I want to bring the topic of discussion now to, it's incredible the journey that you've had in terms of building the company. Now you're 800 employees, right? 12 countries, I think I was reading.
We actually 1,100.
1,100 now, so.
Yeah, know, so
this,
out this, yeah.
This must be from 3 months ago or 6 months ago. Yeah. I know that you're growing very fast. Tell us a little bit, it's a flip question, but I liked it and I will ask you, what were the three top learnings not to be repeated from building the startup so far?
Don't ever do big bang. I mean, you get these ideas sometimes, oh, we need to do a massive change. Let's do a big bang across our whole company. Whenever we've done that, it's been hard and it killed a lot of autonomy and empowerment and because it needed to be centrally coordinated and you got tied up in bureaucracy. So I would say whenever we have leaned on our teams, leaned on empowerment, given the digital teams the freedom to set direction and run, we've been doing extremely well. And whenever we moved another direction, it's been way more painful, right? So I say that's one. Another big one is don't go single market. I think especially European startups have a tendency just to look inwards, look at one country or two countries. Most businesses today is global and require global solutions. So the moment we went global, it you know, cost more, but it helped our commercial success scale a lot faster, right? And then finally, I would say, you know, you have gut feel that there's something wrong with an account, or you should talk to a customer, or, you know, you should do it as fast as possible. Like whenever you have that gut feel in your stomach, listen to it, because it's a lot smarter than your brain is in many ways. And it knows what's wrong way before you necessarily do it. And the amount of times that it helped us just to reach out and talk to people and say, hey, is there an issue here? You know, is there something that's maybe not aligned, but we're not creating value the way we thought we were. That has helped us every single time. And we haven't really lost a lot of customers to date. So I believe that helped us a lot.
And in terms of building global teams, because you have a number of offices, and I also saw also a professional habit of mine, since we do executive search and recruitment, I looked at some of the jobs that you have, which are remote. I think you actually advertise it on your website that there are globally anywhere the person is. Is there a secret recipe for building global teams? Actually, we got a listener asking, is there a special Danish approach, since you're Danish?
sleep less. No, I mean,
Danish butter cookies. I don't know.
Yeah, no. We became global very, very early on. We were 70 people, and I think some of the very big lessons is always use video. Whenever you can, look people face. I mean, eyes. Voice is very different than video. I mean, this sounds trivial, but it's a massive difference. It's the difference between feeling like you're there and working with people. And you know, there's so many great video platforms today that's not really an issue. I think teams that need to collaborate, bring them together early in the beginning. So you do the team build early, and then they can easily go remote and be separated after. But that early DNA and team build is super important in creating that cultural connection. And then I think, you know, as a company, right, we are a global network. Our thesis is that business software is going to be networked, that everybody is going to get connected. We can hardly sort of do all of that and then advertise that we don't want our employees to be a network either, right? So I think it's just in our DNA to think in networks. And I think the more organizations in the future will think in networks, the more remote work is also just going to be a natural part of that landscape.
How about your biggest mistakes in terms of hiring?
Oh, look, you know, there's many situations where I would say you hire a little bit too fast ahead of the curve, right? You hire some big shot from a big company. And you think, you know, they have all the answers. And what you often find out is that, you know, sometimes you got to be a little careful, even if it's a big title and a big CV, because just because you know how to solve things at a, you know, 100,000 people company, you might not know how to solve them at a 1,000 people company. So I think that's probably one of the biggest ones. I would touch out on, and another one is again and again, you know, the people that have proven track records and solving difficult problems, even if they didn't succeed necessarily, it should be always the people who keep surprising us and keep surprising me over and over, and how much value that.
Mm. And final question: there's aspiring entrepreneurs listening to this podcast, as well as corporate people that maybe want to step into the entrepreneurial life at some point. What would be one or two pieces of advice that you would give as a successful entrepreneur? We can say. With confidence, right? To them, what would you share if to somebody that would embark on this entrepreneurial journey?
Look, it's about grit. You would be surprised how many of our competitors we've killed off over time just by being more stubborn and lasting longer. So the one who have the most grit and can last the longest often is end up being the winner of a category. So I think that's more important than anything. And then two, as a budding entrepreneur, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. I see a lot of young people who are getting themselves burned out within the first year of being an entrepreneur. We've been doing this for 10 years now. And if you look at me, you know, for Tradeshift, and you know, I've been doing startups since I was 19, so my whole life, right? And I think in the early days, we ran like there was no tomorrow. And that's great. And there's a lot of, like, you know, startup blogs and all sorts that is hyping that approach. but it got to be sustainable because most companies these days are going to take 10 to 15 years to really build to scale. So pace yourself for that time length and not just the 12 months.
Excellent advice. Well, Christian, been a pleasure. Really, really enjoyed the conversation. Great examples, practical case studies, and wish you all the best and all the success with TradeShip.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It was a joy to be here.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcotglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.